October 26, 2012, Vrindavan, India. Nectar Devotion, Chapter 14, Part 2. Okay, so our last item here that is not one of the angas of bhakti is gyan. Now, of course, there's a kind of bhakti gyan. There's studying the shastra, for example, which is one of the most important angas of bhakti. But here we're talking about a different kind of knowledge. So in contrast to questions about varnashram and karma-covered bhakti, and in contrast to the problems I see with thinking vairagya is an anga of bhakti, we have not seen, at least in my experience, that many devotees who think that material gyan is an anga of bhakti. Sometimes we have people who think that an anga of bhakti is to be a Sanskrit scholar or to, you know, be a psychiatrist or something like that. So that's not generally the case. Generally, most devotees understand that that kind of gyan is simply useful in Krishna service and is not bhakti itself. So I'm not going to spend much time on it. And then Prabhupada also talking about ahimsa. How ahimsa is, again, a result of bhakti rather than a qualification or an anga of bhakti. He gives the example of Magrari. So bhakti causes knowledge, it causes renunciation, it causes nonviolence, it causes all these wonderful things, but these wonderful things do not cause bhakti. And then Prabhupada talks about the 9 processes of devotional service. So as we already did in our exercise the other day, that one could take the 64 items of bhakti and we could analyze them. Remember, we all did that. And then something that you should know, and if you spent any time in Mayapur around the samadhi, you'll see sculptures like this, that each of the items of devotional service can be linked to a particular person. So, who exemplifies hearing? Chanting? Remembering? Praying? Worshipping Krishna's feet? Lakshmi. You can all say. Not that only one person has to say. Deity worship? Good. Being a servant? Friendship, Arjuna, complete surrender, Bali Maharaj, and all 9 of them, Ambarish Maharaj. Swami Prabhupada talks about a lot. Okay, I think there's one more thing that I wanted to. Okay, one last point from this chapter, and then we'll take the questions, is we had mentioned that how do we know how to apply yukta vairagya and what we can use. And I said to follow, that we have to do that by, how do we know? By guru. And Prabhupada then makes a comment about guru. This is on page 116. The spiritual master must never be carried away by an accumulation of wealth or a large number of followers. So Prabhupada's basically saying you have to know how to use things in Krishna's service by asking the guru. But if the guru is bewildered by wealth and followers, they can't help you to engage in yukta vairagya, because they don't know how to do it themselves. Now, Prabhupada then says, a bona fide spiritual master will never become like that. But sometimes, if a spiritual master is not properly authorized and only on his own initiative becomes a spiritual master, he may be carried away by an accumulation of wealth and a large number of disciples. Now, I don't want to say too much about this, but I just simply want to make the point that obviously what Srila Prabhupada understands as being authorized and the policies we have developed in our society about what is being authorized are not the same. Because Srila Prabhupada is saying, if someone's not authorized but becomes a spiritual master on his own account. Now, in our society, we don't have anybody who's become a spiritual master on their own. On their own initiative. We have an authorization process. Obviously, our authorization process must not be the valid authorization process.
So, what is the actual authorization?
That's a good question. What is the actual authorization process? Does Prabhupada ever say that the authorization process is by the votes of a committee? Is that anywhere in the Shastra?
Is that the first verse of the Nectar instruction?
Yes. We got that earlier. And what else is the authorization? Then Prabhupada says here, at the very end of this paragraph, one should therefore strictly adhere to the principles of disciplic succession. What is the authorization process? No, it's not on his own initiative.
If he makes this qualification.
But it's not on the person's own initiative.
Different levels.
There's different levels. But how would somebody following the disciplic succession become a guru but not on their own initiative? How would they be authorized? Well, we find that a guru can, not just some other guru, but that person's guru. That person's guru can give the order. You become guru. Of course, how did Prabhupada get the order to become guru? Bhakti Sanjaya Saraswati said, you go and preach. And Prabhupada understood that as the order to be guru. Didn't he? Yes, he did. And so did Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
And somebody who was accepted spiritual master's teaching, much as the guru, but to be on externally, you know, to get permission to initiation and become.
Like, there's nothing in the, from Sadhu Shastra Guru about getting permission. It doesn't exist. Anyway, I just want to put that out there, that what Srila Prabhupada is talking about in this paragraph is quite interesting. What does it mean to be properly authorized? If we take this paragraph as saying what it says, if we don't interpret it or skew it in any way, if we just simply take the language of this paragraph as it is, then clearly we have not understood what a proper authorization process is. Just by logic and the English language. And anyway, the point is here that one who is a preacher, one who is a guru, should be careful that they're actually properly authorized, that they don't just on their own become a spiritual master, that they're actually becoming a spiritual master in proper disciplic succession. And they have to make sure that they are never carried away by followers and money. Because if you're carried away by followers and money, you cannot lead your followers properly in the discharge of their own service. I'm just going to, just simply that that's another part of this. I don't want to get into it in depth, but that's another part of this chapter. All right, we are going to start tomorrow afternoon on Raghunuga Bhakti. So there's two chapters on Raghunuga Bhakti, two chapters on Bhava Bhakti, and one chapter on Prema Bhakti. So this is going to be quite a shift. But we've had different sections. So the first section of the Nectar Devotion was, what we start out with was what? Well, first though, very beginning. Definition of bhakti, and then qualifications to start bhakti, and then eligibility and different levels. Defining sadhana bhakti, raghunuga bhakti, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti, and then what we've been spending a lot of time on,
64.
The 64 angas of bhakti. And now we're going to, again, two chapters on raghunuga bhakti, two chapters on bhava bhakti, and one chapter on prema bhakti. which shows that Raghu Yoga Bhakti starts, of course, before Bhava Bhakti. So we'll be, it's kind of odd that we're starting that tomorrow and then we have 2 days break. So we're starting like a new section. It would probably be best to first have a break and then start it, but anyway. So we're going to start that new section tomorrow, then have 2 days break, and then we finish next week, and next Friday, a week from today, will be our last class. Yeah, I don't think we have class on Monday. No class Sunday or Monday, yeah? You might have class on Bhagavad Gita, but not with me. Break from nectar devotion. I didn't say break from everything.
Break from. I have a glimpse of hope there.
Oh, yeah. Just in case you want to know, the schedule they have me on is pretty intense, too. All right. On chapter 13, just a few questions today. 5 kinds of devotion activities are recommended in the revered scriptures only to bring to the point of Krishna consciousness. The one who's already developed spontaneous attachment does not require the duties presented in the scriptures. Yes? So what is the question exactly? This is on page 112. Oh yeah, this is talking about Varna and Ashram. Alright, one should execute the prescribed duties of Varna and Ashram as long as he's not developed spontaneous attachment for healing about ritualistic ceremonies of religion. All these are recommended for persons who have not developed Krishna consciousness. They're only to bring one to the point of Krishna consciousness. So the purpose of Varna and Ashram is to bring one to the point of Krishna consciousness. But you can come to the point of Krishna consciousness without Varna and Ashram, but that's what they're for. And once you come to Krishna consciousness, you don't need them anymore. Of course, most devotees will still follow some aspects of Varna and Ashram. If you don't follow any aspects of Varna and Ashram, what are you? You're an avaduta. If you're not following any, then you're really outside society. You're just completely outside society. I remember in one of my doctoral classes, we were talking about culture, and the professor asked, is it possible for any human being to be without a culture? And it's interesting, because until he asked that question, I'd always thought, well, yeah, when you're pure devotee, you're without a culture. But then I realized that's not actually true. Srila Prabhupada was operating within a culture. Yudhisthira Maharaj was operating within a culture. They were not operating outside of culture. The only persons who operate outside of culture are the avadutas. Okay, one should not try to understand the topics of the 10th canto, such as Rasalila, love dance. What is the measure of one's awakening, standing, and spontaneous attraction for Krishna, personal application preaching, which is qualification for hearing or reading the 10th canto? Okay, well, first of all, Srila Prabhupada wrote Krishna book very early in the Hare Krishna movement. And we distribute Krishna book to people on the street. Correct? We do not have in our book stand. We do not have a Raghunuga Bhakti test that you have to pass before you can buy the Krishna book. And in the Krishna book, the Rasalila chapters are there. They're not, we don't have those sealed, you know. You seal the Rasalila chapters and you have to have your Raghunuga key to open the chapters. So, Srila Prabhupada is so wonderful that he made even Rasalila available to people on the street. People on the street. I mean, I was out there on the street selling Krishna book to meat eaters. And they're reading Krishna book. And Prabhupada presented the 10th canto so expertly with this purport, almost impossible to misunderstand. I mean, I guess if you're really determined to misunderstand, you could, but almost impossible. Almost. 99.9%. You cannot read Prabhupada's Krishna book and misunderstand. And he gave that immediately. You know, when Prabhupada left us, he'd only translated up through Canto 10, Chapter 13. Chapter 13 was his last chapter that he translated. So Prabhupada never translated the Bhagavatam Asmi. But we have a Krishna book. And anybody can read. Now, we don't suggest that if you're a neophyte devotee, you only read that. Some devotees did that in the beginning of the movement, and Prabhupada got very angry. They had their Gopi Baba Club, and they were just reading the Rasalila section of Krishna book over and over again. Prabhupada was very angry. But as part of our reading, as part of our study, just like Prabhupada told us in Back to Godhead, not to have intimate articles about Krishna and the gopis, but he said we are not boycotting the gopis. They are our worshipful deities. I mean, and in most Hare Krishna temples, there's Radha and Krishna right on the altar. You can't miss them. We're not hiding. We're not hiding Radharani. A big curtain in front of Radharani. Who's that next to Krishna? No, first you have to be Raghavan Bhakti, then you can see. So we're open to the world, but because Srila Prabhupada is so expert, I mean, it's very rare. It happens, but it's very, very rare to find somebody who was trained by Srila Prabhupada in Prabhupada's books who misunderstands Krishna's Vrindavan Leela. That's very unusual. I mean, I can count maybe three or four people that I've met who've read Prabhupada's purports who misunderstand Krishna's Vrindavan Leela and Krishna's Rasalila. It just doesn't happen. So, but what I see Srila Prabhupada is saying here is don't pretend to be more than what you are. But by the way, don't pretend to be less than what you are either. In the Niyamagraha's, it's one of my Bhaktiloka, one of my favorite books. In the Niyamagraha section, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says you fall down if you go too fast or too slow. And he said, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, if you remain attached to the rules of the previous step, they will act like chains around your feet. So we have to be willing to move up when it's time to move up, and we should also not move up before we're ready to move up. So don't stay on a lower level when you're ready to come to a higher level, and don't jump to a higher level before you can go to a higher level. But I see here what Prabhupada's referring to are people who just want to read about Krishna and the gopis. They don't want to read about anything else. I mean, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was reading about Dhruva and Prahlad with Gadadhar Pandit, who's Radharani, and they were crying. So Mahaprabhu and Gadadhar Pandit are reading about Dhruva Maharaj and they're crying in ecstasy. And that's Radha Krishna. So we can't read about Dhruva, we can't read about Prithu Maharaj. Prabhupada said the devotee doesn't neglect one drop. But if a devotee is in the conjugal rasa, naturally they'll reach a point that they particularly want to relish the stories of Krishna and the conjugal rasa. I mean, that's natural. Like if you're a devotee in Vatsalya rasa, you're naturally going to want to focus on the stories of Krishna with his parents. Just like Prabhupada writes in, I think, third chapter. Anyways, writes about Mother Yasoda, I think it's in the third chapter of 10th canto, who's churning butter. You know, she's churning butter and she's perspiring and the flowers are falling out of her hair and her body is shaking with the churning. And Prabhupada says those devotees who are in Vatsalya rasa, they should meditate on this scene of Mother Yasoda. So again, it's natural if your feelings for Krishna awaken like that, you'll want to meditate on the Damodara Leela and all these leelas. And if you're in the Sakya rasa, you want to meditate on Krishna's cowardly leelas. So that's natural. But even those devotees, they're reading everything. It's not that they're only reading that, but they may focus on that. So not to do that imitatively or prematurely. And what's the qualification that we'll come to in the next few chapters? What is the symptoms of Raghunatha Bhakti? Is it good to be in an ashram? Ashram can mean two things. Did you see any empowerment if you're in an ashram? Lord Chaitanya said, I'm not a sannyasi, grahasta, brahmachari, I am a devotee of Krishna. There are people in grahasta ashram where one is not devotee and their life is not good. There's not much value to being in an ashram or a varna without Krishna consciousness. The value to being in an ashram and varna without Krishna consciousness is it can prepare you for the yoga ladder and it can take you to heaven. So I guess it's better to go to heaven than to become an animal. Okay. But it's all temporary. You know, it's one day you'll be on earth, one day you'll be in heaven, one day you'll be an animal, one day you'll be this, one day you'll be that. So it's not that meaningful. I can prepare you for the yoga ladder. Is it good to be in an ashram? Certainly, it's helpful. The ashrams are designed to take the particularly the material attachments in our life and help us focus them on Krishna. Help us become attached to Krishna and detached from Maya. That's what the ashrams are meant for. And someone who's not properly situated in one of the ashrams, it's harder. There's no question about it. It's harder. If you can be a proper brahmachari, proper grahasta, proper vanaprastha, proper sannyasi. Of course, as I said before, most people are not proper anything. You know, if you really look at the regulations in the Bhagavatam and the Manu Samhita for the different ashrams, very few people are actually properly situated in an ashram. That's going to be unusual. But as far as possible, it's quite helpful. I see it's very helpful. I mean, I see people who are artificially in a renounced ashram or artificially in the grahasta ashram or not really in any ashram, that their lives are more difficult. That's what I just see practically, at a practical level. So if somebody, I was just talking to someone today, so he's like 28 years old, he has a job, he has, you know, all these electronic gadgets and cars and money and this and that, but he doesn't want to get married. He says, I just want to stay a brahmachari. I said, Prabhu, you're not a brahmachari. He says, you're not a brahmachari. I said, you're already like a grahasta, you're just missing the life. You know, he said, oh, I've heard grahasta life is so much trouble. I said, yeah, material life is so much trouble, it doesn't matter. You get married, you don't get married, you this or that, everybody has trouble. So, you know, that's not helpful. And then somebody like that gets to be 45 and all of a sudden says, oh, now I want to get married. And then they're still married when they're 70 and their children are only 5 years old. And, yes. And at the same time, you see also sometimes people in the grahasta ashram and they don't want to have a house and they don't want to have children and they don't want to earn money and they want to run around the world like a sannyasi. So that doesn't help either. You know, if you're a grahasta, be a grahasta, and if you're a renunciate, be a renunciate. I have a whole lecture, a whole seminar I could give on this. But basically, whatever you want to be it. As much as you can in this present time in Kali Yuga. As much as possible. And some people are the real deal. I mean, I've met some devotees in ISKCON who are really paka paka. Brahmacharis, paka paka. Grahastas, paka. Sannyasis. But it's unusual. Usually people are a little funny. Right? True? Is that correct? Usually we're a little, something's not quite, you know, not right. But the people who really have a hard time are people who are kind of like, they're not this and they're not that. You know, they're 35 and they've never been married, but they're not really a renunciate. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard if someone's not really anything. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sometimes we see that people, like, it says, living outside, they're not, but seems happy in the sense like, maybe they may have taken this because they don't want to take up responsibility. Like somebody who's outside and has money and they don't want to marry. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll give you my little lecture on this. I'll try to make it fast because you're all tired. So, let's just go to third chapter Bhagavad Gita. So, without sacrifice, you can't live happily in this life or the next, right? You all remember that from third chapter Bhagavad Gita? Okay, and in the Bhagavatam, Krishna says, I create, maintain, and destroy by penance only. So, the ultimate sacrifice is a sacrifice of love. The ultimate, the real sacrifice, the real penance, the real austerity is I love Krishna and I give everything to Krishna out of love. Now, someone who's not doing that, they're in the material world, and whatever you want to enjoy here, you have to pay for it. So there's vikarma. Vikarma means you steal. That's vikarma. Vikarma means I want to get some happiness, and I don't want to pay for it. I don't want to do any sacrifice. So our modern society is a society of vikarma. I was talking earlier about the happiness of Vairagya. There's a lot of happiness in Vairagya. You have freedom. Freedom is nice. Everybody wants freedom. So that, the main happiness of the renounced ashrams is freedom. The main happiness of the grahastha ashram is full engagement of your psychophysical nature, sense gratification, and security. But you don't get all those things at the same time. You can get all those things spiritually at the same time in Krishna. With Krishna, you get full satisfaction of your spiritual senses, and you get full engagement of your nature, and you get full security, you get full freedom. But materially, you cannot get all those things at the same time. You have to give up one thing to get something else. Just like when we were riding here from Delhi with my grandson. This is his first trip to India. And we're seeing the funny, I mean, any of you who've never left India, if you've been in India your whole life, you don't think they're funny, but to those of us who've been in other parts of the world, the trucks in India are very funny. You have very comic trucks. They're these little things, and the mirrors only stick out this much. The trucks in the West, the mirrors stick out this much on the side. Here they only stick out this much. And then they pile these trucks with the, you know, over the... Way overflow. So we saw a number of trucks, of course, that had fallen over. When we were driving from Delhi to Mumbai, all these trucks that had fallen over. And my grandson was asking about it. And I said, they've given up stability. I said, in life, you usually have a choice between two things, stability and flexibility. And you can't have absolute, spiritually you can have absolute both, but materially you can have absolute both. And my grandson said, well, these trucks, they're neither stable nor flexible. You know, so the big trucks we have in the West, they're more flexible. They're in two parts, right? This one. And then they make them unstable by piling them on top. But the point is stability and flexibility, or freedom and security. So in modern age, people try to steal. They try to have both security and freedom. Let me have the security of a job. Let me have the security of money. Let me have the sense gratification of the opposite sex. And let me also have the freedom of the renounced ashrams. I can go where I want and do what I want, eat where I want, and whatever. Let me try to have both. And pay for neither. No sacrifice. Okay, I'm going to tell you guys a secret. If you try to enjoy without paying for it, then your enjoyment becomes a sacrifice. Because Krishna says, I create, maintain, and destroy by sacrifice only. And then there's that wonderful verse, and I wish I remember the Sanskrit, that the all-pervading transcendence is the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. The all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. That means truth is sacrifice. You must sacrifice. You must. It's like our Sanatana Dharma. You must give. You must serve. If you try to take without giving, you can't. We're givers. And therefore, it's going to be forced giving. So these people who look so happy, they're not happy. They can't enjoy their sense gratification. They can't enjoy their freedom. They can't enjoy their security. They don't have anything. They're just miserable. So if you try to take without paying, you're a thief. And then you're always in anxiety. So we said the next step is karma. What is karma? Karma means I know I'm supposed to pay. Okay, if I want the happiness of security and stability and sense gratification and full engagement of my psychophysical nature, then I have to pay. If you want the enjoyment of the opposite sex, you've got to tolerate the opposite sex. Seriously. This one girl asked a man, he said, what men enjoy about women is when women are like this, are up. He said, but then you got to deal with women when they're like this. Right? Do women go like this emotionally? Yes? Those of us who are women? By the way, you reach an age where you don't do that anymore. But at least in your youthful life, do women go like this? Yeah, chemically, women do that. And when the men want to enjoy the women when they're here, then they got to tolerate the women when they're here. And if a woman wants to enjoy a man, she wants to enjoy having someone who's protecting her and taking care of her, then she's got to deal with somebody who's protecting her and taking care of her. Do what he says. And feed his ego. Tell him he's a hero, but he's not. You got to pay the price. There's a price. You have to actually take care of someone. You have to commit to them. You have to be with them when they're up. You have to be with them when they're down. You have to be with them when they're happy. You have to be with them when they're sad. If you want to enjoy the children, the little, you know, cute little voices of the children and the enchantment of the children, then you can take care of the children. You got to change their nappies and clean up their vomit at 2 a.m. And, you know, there's a sacrifice. If you want to enjoy money, you have to earn money honestly. You want to enjoy a house, you have to maintain a house. You want to enjoy the grahastha ashram, you have to take the responsibility of maintaining the society and giving in charity. And if you want to enjoy the freedom of the renounced ashram, then there's also sacrifice. Then you don't have a bank account, then you don't have a home. Then you don't have anybody saying, oh, you're a hero, or oh, you're so beautiful. You don't have that. You have to get enthusiasm from within. You don't have somebody pushing you. You don't have some wife saying, so when are you going to work? You naturally go out and work for Krishna. You don't have that. You have to enthuse yourself. You have to be balanced within you. You have to have a balance of the feminine and masculine energies within yourself. And you have to take responsibility for the society. Prabhupada says, renounce order means you have to write literatures and you have to give room to discourses. You have to take some responsibility for the world as your family. Not, oh, I'm not going to have a family, so I'm not responsible. No, then you become responsible for everybody. If you say, okay, I'm going to be celibate, I'm not going to have children, I'm not going to take care of wife, I'm not going to take care of someone, then you take care of everybody. Prabhupada says, you broaden your, not that you're selfish, I'm just going to enjoy my freedom. There's a sacrifice. But that's karma. Karma is, I take my enjoyment legally, and I do my sacrifice, then I can go to heaven. Then what's higher than that? What's higher than that is karma yoga, where you say, okay, I'm going to get my enjoyment, I'm going to do my sacrifice, but I'm doing it for purification, I'm not doing it to go to heaven. I want moksha. But higher than that is you start saying, who am I paying to? First you're stealing from the store, then you're paying money to the store, but it's just a business deal. Then you start thinking, maybe I should have a relationship with the storekeeper. That's bhakti. You start having a relationship. Start bringing about relationship. And this is what Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati describes so nicely in his purport to Ramasamhita, text 61, and I found another, not a lot of places where Prabhupada also says the same thing. I'm giving the sacrifice to Krishna, and I'm enjoying what comes as prasadam. For Krishna, I'm telling my wife, you're the most beautiful woman in the world. And when my wife cooks me nice parathas, and that's Krishna's prasadam. For Krishna, I'm saying, okay, I have no money, I just have 3 saris and no home. And when I get the freedom, that's Krishna's prasadam. It's all connected with Krishna. And one starts relishing the service, and after a while one starts becoming attached to Krishna, and one takes pleasure simply in serving Krishna, then when I'm voluntarily doing the sacrifice as an offering to Krishna, then what happens? Everything merges into transcendence. The sacrifice becomes part of the bliss. So for the Vikarmis, the enjoyment turns into a sacrifice. The enjoyment turns into an austerity. Their whole life is just austerity. Modern people, their whole life is just suffering. It's all suffering. If you want to steal. For the pious person, they get some material pleasure and the more passion, and then it's mixed. They get, you know, their suffering is, their sacrifice is suffering, and their sense pleasure is their enjoyment. Mixed happiness and distress. For one who's working for purification, everything starts to become blissful. And for one who's in Krishna consciousness, you can no longer distinguish between your pleasure and your sacrifice. It's all pleasure. You can't make a line like that. You can no longer say, I'm doing this sacrifice to enjoy freedom, or I'm doing this sacrifice to enjoy sense gratification. It's not like that anymore. Everything becomes transcendence. So the ashrams are specifically meant to facilitate that transition from stealing to pious to transcendence. That's their function. Because they give you a blueprint. You want to enjoy this? Do this sacrifice. You want to enjoy this? Do this sacrifice. You want to enjoy this? Do this. And they're the same. Coin, different size. You want to enjoy money? Earn money. You want to enjoy detachment? You have to be detached. You follow? You want to enjoy the opposite sex? You tolerate the opposite sex. You want to enjoy a house? You maintain a house. It's the same. They're like this. So this mentality of vikarma, because after all, we're preaching in the society, we're bringing in people from the society, many of us have been brought up in this outside society. So it affects us, and we tend to have the same mentality, we have a tendency to have this mentality for vikarma. We have a tendency to have this mentality for stealing. So you see people, that you know, you can look at them and you know they should have been married 10 years before, and they're still trying to pretend that they're renounced, but they're trying to enjoy both. So the renunciate, you know, you see sometimes this renunciate, they're surrounded by 300 women all going, ah, right? And they have all this money in the account. You've seen this? Yes. You don't want to say, oh, you've seen this. All right. So that's trying to enjoy both. You're trying to enjoy the pleasure of the renounced ashram and the grihastha ashram. And you see people in the grihastha ashram, they don't work, they don't take care of their wife, they refuse to have any children, and they're traveling around like a renunciate, and their family life falls apart. And there again, they're trying to do both at the same time. So that's not the ashram is not like that. The ashram is whatever you do, do it honestly, do it well, do it really. See who you are, what you are, and then be authentic. If you're a grihastha, be an authentic grihastha. Like Prabhupada said, grihastha life means house, wife, children. Why are they trying to make it something else? If you're a grihastha, be a real grihastha. And if you're a vanaprastha, be a real vanaprastha. You're a ramachari, be a real ramachari. As much as you can in the Kali, you do it perfectly. As much as possible.
Prabhupada has also encouraged so many investors to take up preaching and...
Preaching is fine. Of course, in the beginning of the movement, we had an emergency. Because you only had like 50, 60 devotees. So Prabhupada would sometimes ask people to do things that were a little unusual. Everybody should preach. I'm not saying you shouldn't preach. Everybody should preach. But if husband and wife are simply traveling to home places and simply traveling as preachers and they're not having children, not making money, they're not grihasthas, then they're vanaprasthas. And they should live like vanaprasthas. Vanaprastha ashram is a bona fide ashram. Then be a vanaprastha. But decide. don't try to be a little of this and a little of that.
How is it that one changes?
How is
that transition from vanaprastha to just one day?
For me, it was just one day.
One just decides and
Well, I
obviously it's a little different for different people,
and it depends whether people have run across as husband and wife together or husband and wife not together. I mean, for myself, it was gradual. I'd say for my husband, it was like over 3 years that I finally said to him, "Are you still a Grahasta?" I said, "You don't seem to be a Grahasta anymore." I said, "Do you still want to be a Grahasta, or do you want to be a Vanaprastha? What do you want to be?" I said, "You're hanging around here, and you're letting me cook for you, letting me take care of you, but you're not into Grahasta life anymore. You're not earning money, you're not taking care of things. What do you want to do?" And he said, "I want to be a Vanaprastha." He was 52 years old, and our oldest son was married, and we don't know. And we talked to, you know, GBC, and he said, "Yeah, go for it." But even then, I'd say for, you know, I don't know for him, but for me, the psychological transition was gradual. So even after he started traveling, for me, definitely the psychological transition was gradual. And my adopting of external things and external renunciation was also gradual. It wasn't my situation now and my situation then are not the same. So, I see for different people, you know. For some, the husbands and wives are traveling together to holy places and preaching.
If somebody takes the mantras that age is 14.
Yeah, but that's a general. Prabhupada took vanaprastha, he was 54.
So if somebody takes 40, is it worth
it? It depends on the person. Prabhupada says you can go directly from the Brahmacharya ashram to the Vanaprastha ashram. You don't have to go through the Grahastha ashram. I mean, frankly, most of our older Brahmacharis are really in the Vanaprastha ashram.
So what's the difference?
You know, right now it's a little hard to say. One difference is that the Vanaprastha still can live with the wife or have communication with the wife, and the sannyasi cannot. That's one big difference. And, you know, it's a little funny to say, because, like, there's a sacred sannyasi who lives at a holy place, and a vanaprastha can also live at a holy place. Like Prabhupada talked about having the vanaprasthas live here in Vrindavan and in Mayapur. He said, "This can be your vana, your Vrindavana." And especially Prabhupada wanted Vrindavan and Mayapur as a place for vanaprasthas to live. And we see that there are elderly couples who live here in Vrindavan, retired here, or sometimes just an elderly man or an elderly woman. I mean, there's different kinds of sannyasis too. There's the four levels of sannyasi. One sannyasi lives outside the village and his children bring him food. And then there's a sannyasi who bakes door to door, and the one who goes out preaching. And then there's the paramahamsa who may not even preach and just stay in a holy place. The main dharma for the vanaprastha is austerity.
Is a renunciation?
Austerity, particularly, performing austerities. And the main dharma for the sannyasi is, Prabhupada says, purification and resistance. In the traditional vanaprastha, vana ashram system, only the brahmanas would take sannyas, and only the kshatriyas and the brahmanas would take to the vanaprastha ashram. The Sudras only had the Grahastha ashram, and the Vaishyas only had the Brahmacharya and the Grahastha ashram. But anyway, it depends. I mean, you take up to the Vanaprastha ashram, you'd have to have at least one grown married child. Because if you leave home, then that child could take care of the younger children. Someone else. You can't take Vanaprastha if you have young children. If all your children are young, okay. That's one reason to marry. If you're going to marry, the Prabhupada says you should marry young. He said after 30, marriage is not so pleasing. If you're going to marry, you should marry when you're young. And one of the reasons for that is there's a natural kind of renunciation that happens in midlife. It happens to the materialist too. It happens to everybody. For the materialistic persons, they just say, "Oh, I'm tired of my wife now, let me find somebody else." You know? But it's a natural sort of detachment that happens.
For Brahmacharis, it is easy after 35. For Brahmacharis, it is easy after the mid-age, 35, 37.
Where's your Shastra from?
I heard from somebody.
That's nice. Chalamani Shastra. I don't know any Shastra. I don't see it practically. I mean, that's not what I see practically. At all. So if you're going to marry, marry young. And then by the time you're 50, you have some grown-up children. There has to be some grown-up children. And if there's been no children, then there has to be some consideration for the wife. You know, you're just going to leave the wife at home alone, or you travel with the wife. I see it depends. The main thing in Vanaprastha is, what are you giving up? You're giving up sex and money. Those are the main things you're giving up. That question, because, you know, to take sannyas, you have to be initiated into the sannyas order. I mean, you can live like a sannyasi without being an official sannyasi. I'd say Ayendra Prabhu was living as a sannyasi. Or you might say as a kshetra sannyasi, or as a vanaprastha again. You might categorize him as a vanaprastha or a kshetra sannyasi. And we have many, many devotees who are living like that without officially being sannyas. I don't know. I see in some, I don't, as far as scripture, I don't see anything like that in the scripture. And I don't know any instructions like that from Srila Prabhupada. And I don't know any historical examples from that. But I do know a number of devotees, friends of mine, who, when entering into the Vanaprastha ashram, took permission from their guru or from the authorities, and we did. I mean, I've seen some devotees actually have like a ceremony that they go through. But again, I don't see that in the tradition. I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt. I mean, in the Shastra, we have some people who took Vanaprastha course even at a young age, like Maharaj Anga. You know, he just got disgusted and left in the middle of the night. He became a Vanaprastha. Prabhupada said, however you become renounced, whether you become renounced by, you know, planning or by circumstances. And you're also, Vanaprastha life also means you're giving your, when I say give up money, I mean you're giving up your means of maintaining a livelihood, because the varnas are especially for the grahastha ashram. So the full range of using your psychophysical nature in Krishna service is mostly for the grahastha ashram. It wouldn't be appropriate for someone in the Vanaprastha order to be, you know, running a grocery store, or, you know what I'm saying? You're finished with that. You're finished with economic development and sense gratification, basically. Which means that you no longer have the full range of activities open to you. Is that clear to everyone? So those are the main components of the Vanaprastha ashram. But the idea is that you're supposed to live a life where you're really focusing on becoming attached to Krishna. And therefore naturally detached from the material way of life. You're preparing for death, I mean, if we want to just put it bluntly. And of course, as Srila Prabhupada's followers, we're all meant to be preachers. We're all meant to be preachers. And, you know, it depends on what your particular position is and what your service is. But if you have the facility, so we have in our Hare Krishna movement, I'd say that the majority of our traveling preachers are either sannyasis or vanaprastas. Some who are apparently, we call them brahmacharis, but they're not really, they're really vanaprastas. But for grahastas to essentially travel and preach is a little strange. Grahastas are supposed to have a griha. So that's a little odd. What would you recommend is the best way to become absorbed in Srimad Bhagavatam? Meditate on it. Really think about it. Try to envision the leelas taking place. Think about the persons as persons. The Maharaj Pariksit is a real person. That, you know, Aditi is a real person. And be around other people who relish Srimad Bhagavatam. And I was at a retreat. I was asked, how do you study the Bhagavatam? So I just took everyone in the retreat and put them in a circle, about 30 people, and we just went around and I said, how do you study the Bhagavatam? How do you study the Bhagavatam? How do you study the Bhagavatam? And everyone had a different way, and every way was amazing. So one person said, well, I take the purports and turn them into a poem. And another one said, well, I take the verses and purports and turn them into questions and answers, and I put them on my blog and on the internet as a way of preaching. And someone else said, well, I like to study with a friend, and we read and we ask each other questions. And someone else said, well, I look at the Sanskrit and the word for word, and I find other verses that have the same Sanskrit, and I see if it's always translated the same way and what it means in context. And so forth and so on. And somebody else said, you know, well, I take it and I make it into a picture. And someone else said, well, I take it and I make it into a diagram. These were all very serious. These were all disciples of a particular guru in ISKCON who urges his disciples to read Prabhupada's books for 2 hours every day. So they were all very serious students of the Shastras. Is detachment enough to love Krishna? No. Loving Krishna is enough to give you detachment. Did Srila Prabhupada mention he wanted to reestablish one ashram system? Yes, definitely. Because for the people in general, if you don't establish one ashram, they're all vikarmis. They're all stealing you. And the whole society is in chaos. Definitely. Yes?
Sometimes.
Because sometimes the person who's in one ashram thinks they already have everything.
To a good materialist, to an outsider, who is a vikari.
Yes.
To him, but if we give him Krishna consciousness,
yes,
it will be more attractive than giving him one ashram, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think so. I hope so.
He'll be more attractive towards.
I hope. What's more attractive? Krishna playing his flute and throwing the ball around and stealing the butter? Or why don't you be a good, pious person in the world and go to heaven? I know what's more attractive to me, and maybe to somebody else it's more attractive to be a good, pious person in the world and go to heaven. I mean, look, if you go to most people in the world today and you say, okay, we're going to teach you the rules and regulations of our scripture, how you can be a good, moral, and ethical person in the world and go to heaven, do you think very many people are going to be interested in that?
And how are we trying to establish one ashram?
We call this Saved by the Bell. It's 432. So how do we establish one ashram? This question has been discussed by far greater minds than ours. Actually, there's one purport where Prabhupada said, if we go on Harinam, Brahmins and Kshatriyas will manifest automatically. What I am seeing in our Hare Krishna movement is that many of the best parts of our ashram are starting to manifest automatically. That's what I'm seeing practically.